and it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and said, we're not alone.
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, everyone, and we are coming at you live right in from Phoenix, Arizona, at the International UFO Congress. And we have some people are going to be doing a bit of a round robin out here. Alejandro is way too busy, so he can't even stop in to say hi. However, we just made it by the seat of our pants. I can't even get into the chat room right now. The internet went down. We grabbed Ethernet cables, grabbed another computer. We have no idea how to use it. Ryan Sprague is here. He helped me. Robert Farrell is here right now. Robert was an early guest on our show. He just came out with a book. But I really enjoyed him. You were one of my first guests, Robert, way, way back.
I was.
You were. And you talked about propulsion. I'd like to talk to, I know you want to probably talk about your new book, but I want to talk about the propulsion that we talked about way back then. And before we get into that, I want to introduce Ryan Sprague here. Ryan was on the show, I think, a couple of times, and we've been in touch all along. It's great to see him out here. And Ryan, why don't you introduce yourself and talk quickly about your what's going on in New York City? And also, can you, because I wasn't able to get into the show too much today, can you talk about the guests a little bit?
Yeah, sure. We had some really, really interesting speakers today. To start it off, we had Clifford Mohudi, who was a member of the Zuni Pueblo tribe. And he spoke a lot about a lot of the spirituality behind the Star People and how the ancient tribes are connected to what we would consider today as aliens and what many people would consider ancient aliens. So that was really interesting. And then we had a bit of a switcheroo. We were going to have Thomas Reed today, but he was replaced because of inclement weather. We had Linda Zimmerman, who spoke about the Hudson Valley sightings. So that was really, really interesting. She went into great detail about many cases that that we weren't aware of, that people like J. Allen Hynek and others researched. And then we had even more New York sightings with Cheryl Costa, who is actually from my hometown of Syracuse, New York. So that was really exciting for me to hear her talk about cases from the last 200 years that took place where I grew up. And it astounded me. She was saying names of streets that I grew up on and rode my bike down, and a supposed UFO crash in Mattydale, New York, which is 10 minutes from my house. So that was really exciting. We had Joan Bird, who talked about Montana UFOs. A lot of geographical UFO stuff today. Yeah. So, yeah.
I just wanted to say something about Joan. Poor Joan Bird. I went right up to her and I said, Joan, have you been avoiding me? You were going to be on my show and you vanished, and put her right on the spot. And she's all apologizing and said, you know, she's been traveling all through Europe and family stuff and all kinds of things. So I forgave her. We're now friends again. And I told her that I'm going to be nudging her fairly soon. So I just want to say I was lucky enough to get out on, you know, through this bad weather. Really, it's been really something else in Maine. And I made it here, but, you know, it's just incredible out here. It's, what is it, 80 degrees today? 82. Yeah, I don't want to leave. I'm hoping something happens to the plane. I want to say we have an audience, too. Can we hear a clap from the audience? It's a single audience, but I did some listeners showed up and I talked with them today. That was absolutely awesome. And George is joining us now, and I did invite a couple of others. Maybe they'll straggle in. And also I want to say that we will be having some people pop in today that's going to be with us throughout the show. I told most people, I said, everyone's coming early. Ends up two people came early, but there will be some people coming in. Hopefully we'll see Stanton Friedman poke his head in the door. We invited Richard Dolan, but he looked very tired. I don't think we're going to be seeing him. Linda Zimmerman may be popping in. And, geez, you were with me. Who else, Ryan? Do you remember? Is there someone else? I think there's someone else, but whoever it is, it'll be a surprise.
Mystery guest.
Yeah, the mystery guest. So, Robert, getting back, first, can you explain the book you have out now? And is there any pertinence to UFOs in that book at all, or is this just a whole different genre?
Well, it is kind of a departure from my other books. And what led me down this path was the late Zachariah Sitchin's book, The Twelfth Planet, which most people, I think, have read. And one of the things he commented on in The Twelfth Planet was Noah's Flood. So I've always been curious about that. Did a lot of research on it, and now I've come out with a book on it. It's called The Science Behind Noah's Flood. And I dedicate a whole chapter to Zachariah Sitchin's, to his book, The Twelfth Planet, because he wrote that back in 1976, and a lot has happened scientifically since then that turned out to verify almost everything that he said. In fact, I was going to have a subtitle on the book called The Redemption of Zachariah Sitchin, but I decided not to. But this book, I start off by giving people a glimpse of some of the ancient stories like Atrahasis, and then Gilgamesh, the Epic of Gilgamesh. And finally, I talk a little bit about Noah's Flood out of the Bible, out of the Genesis. And I compare the three so people can see, hey, they're all related. And the reason I did that is because my point was this book is dedicated to Noah's Flood, not all the other floods that have occurred around the world. There have been hundreds of them that have been reported, but I'm focusing on Noah's Flood as it is in the Bible. And I wanted to show that Noah's Flood originally was part of Sumerian culture, the ancient Sumerians, and that's what Sitchin wrote about. So I do that. Then I talk about Sitchin, and I go through item by item, and I show the scientific evidence that supports what he had said, which a lot of people didn't believe at the time. And then after that, I launch into a few hypotheses as to what caused the flood, when it happened, where it happened, and what caused it. And people may have read some of the books. One of them was called Noah's Flood, written by a couple of scientists from Lamont Doggerty. And then there was another book, another hypothesis, I should say, that was presented by Dr. Bruce Massey. And I think he works at, trying to remember where he works, but some scientific organization. He's got good credentials. Then I end up talking about Zachariah Sitchin's take on Noah's Flood and end up expanding on that. But his belief was that the flood occurred 13,000 years ago as a result of melting ice down in Antarctica because we were coming out of the Ice Age. And he thought that that resulted perhaps in some mega tsunamis that was the flood itself. So I did more research on that because a lot has come to the surface in the last 45 years. There's more information, and I kind of refined that hypothesis. And my hypothesis, based on Sitchin's now, is that it occurred about 14,700 years ago, maybe 14,000 years ago. At that time, Noah was a late Stone Age person. But there was this major collapse of ice sheets in Antarctica. And by the way, it's along the eastern coast of Antarctica, which faces directly into the Indian Ocean and faces directly into the Straits of Hormuz, which means this mega tsunami that was created, and actually I think it was a series of tsunamis, who had been focused and traveled up into the Persian Gulf. At that time it was a lake. And would have picked up Noah and his family as they were in Serapak, which is a little south of Baghdad, would have carried them northwest and deposited them in an area which, ironically, is almost where ISIS, you're familiar with ISIS, the bad guys? It's their base camp. And that's about where I think they landed.
That sounds like irony to me.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And from there, they got out of their boat and, of course, headed for high ground, as I would do, And they went up, I think, into what's called the Plain of Haran. It was, of course, it didn't have that name then. And I believe Noah settled in an area in the northwest corner of that plain, which is now called Urfa. Now, the thing is, I'm saying this happened 14,700 years ago or thereabouts. Ironically, overlooking this plain is Göbekli Tepe, which is in the news lately. It's one of the oldest ruins that's been discovered in that area. It's a temple, apparently, been dated to 12,000 years old. But there are other layers down below, and the archaeologist says he's only done 5% of the dig in the last 9 years. So probably he's going to find stuff that's 14,000 years old. Now, you could imagine that Noah, after he founded Urfa, let's say, he would raise kids and his family would have expanded, and he would have built temples to his gods. And the Sumerians worship 12 gods. If you look at pictures of Göbekli Tepe, there's 12 columns, two big ones and usually 10 around them in these circles. So it, to me, it clearly has Sumerian influence, and the timing is about right, about 12 to 14,000 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Well, so the other thing that kind of relates to this is Noah had three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth.
Curly?
Yeah, I'm Curly. So Ham... Ham settled pork. No, Ham actually went down into Canaan and settled into Africa. Seth went down into Shem went down into Saudi Arabia or the Arabian Peninsula. Japheth settled into India and over into Greece and Rome in that area. So you have these three nations of Noah, and there's a map that I show that's kind of interesting because they intersect at one location. And that's at Göbekli Tepe in that area. Another interesting factor is that prior to about 12,000 years ago, people were hunter-gatherers. But at about 12,000 years ago, they invented agriculture. And agriculture spread from the point where it was created out to various directions. But guess where it started? In the area of Göbekli Tepe. And some ancient versions of wheat have been found and genetically determined to be very old, and they are in that same area. And I show a map of how that wheat has spread by age, you know, by date, around almost the same places that the Ham would have gone and that Japheth would have gone. So it all kind of ties together, which I was amazed. When I finished the book, I said, wow, you know, this stuff all fits together.
Huh. Well, we led a little bit of a stray of UFOs.
Show's about. Well, it is a little bit. However, yeah. I do talk a bit about what Sitchin believed, that the Sumerians believed, and that was that there were aliens that came to this planet and created human beings. I do talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of ties in with UFOs.
Yeah. 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 I've never really known what to think about Noah's flood. And I know there's been something like 350 major floods recorded or something like that. And it was funny, I asked a clergyman about what he thought about, you know, Noah's Ark. And he said, a lot of what's in the Bible is the idea of. And I said, fair enough. That sounds kind of right to me, but
that's,
you know,
what I discovered amazingly, that the Old Testament, at least the part that covers Noah's flood, it's the dates are squishy, you know, but it's all there. And in my book, I I show how, for instance, when if you assume that this happened 14,700 years ago, and then I put a date when Noah was born and when he died. And I've traced 10 of his descendants all the way down to Abraham. And the amazing thing is, Noah was still alive up until Abraham was in his 60s. Now, in ancient Jewish tradition, it says that Noah was educated. I mean, that Abraham was educated by Noah. And I also would point out that I believe Abraham was born in Urfa, not Ur. Urfa was where Noah settled, and his whole clan would have been in that area. And indeed, Abraham would have been able to go to school, basically, on the teachings of Noah, who would have taught him the history. Then what happened after, well, it seems like in the Bible it says that Abraham's father, Terah, decided, hey, let's go to Canaan. So he picked up, gathered the family together, and at that time it consisted of Abraham and his younger brother, excuse me, Haran, and his son, Lot. And I visualize them heading off to Canaan. So here they are, they're passing through what is known today as the plain of Haran, and Haran dies. So his father, Terah, stays there. He never did leave the Haran, the plain of Haran, and he named the plain after Haran, his son. And Abraham still lived there for a number of years until he was 75, and then he took Lot into Canaan. That's the history. Now, I was amazed that it fits so well with the descriptions in the Bible. Now, the dates that are in the Bible, I'm not convinced that the world was created 5,000 years ago. And also, when you look at how old Abraham is, you might find a date that he was born 1,948 years after creation. Well, that doesn't work either. So I'm not going to throw out any dates as far as that goes, but I believe the flood occurred when I said it did, that Noah settled into that region, and it all began from that point.
Okay, fair enough. You lost me at Zachariah Stitchin.
Oh.
I'm just saying. No, I'm just trying to make a little humor here.
Okay.
So I want to get back to talking to you later in a few minutes about, you know, the propulsion that we talked about, because I always thought that was very fascinating, how you kind of had a great idea. You know, I've heard different, over the last 3 years, different people talk about different types of supposed propulsion by certain things that they looked at, like I'm trying to remember a person that was on the show. He takes a scientific look at things, and I would have to Google him right now. And I'm just lost for words, Robert, I can't remember it. But anyway, it is interesting. The whole mystery of this whole UFO thing is interesting, but when people try to come up and explore with how they get here from there, I think it's rather fascinating. And I almost said the guy's name. And I want to talk to Ryan. Let's talk about what's going on with you and your book, that you're still in the midst of writing your book, are you? And you're a busy guy. Well, how do you find time to do stuff like this?
I don't. I'm exhausted. I've been working on my first book ever with Richard Dolan. It's coming out later this year, and it focuses primarily on the experiencers, whether it be sightings, encounters, abduction experiences, really putting a microscope on the individual, who they were before it. What happened during, but the most importantly, the aftermath, the implication, how it changed them as a human being, what we consider human, whether it be socially, economically, religiously, sexually, everything, every run of the spectrum, and what this might mean for possibly what it is, what the phenomenon might be, and how it connects to us.
That's something I really never heard anyone actually talk about. And yes, it does affect. I think you know, it's funny. The only time I ever heard someone say it didn't affect them was, and I've said this on the show before, was the most amazing sighting that I've ever heard anyone discuss. It's all I can say. It's a friend of mine. He's on the Antiques Roadshow, so he's not going to say who he is. He had the most amazing, unbelievable sighting. And one of them had very similar to something that Charles Holt saw, the thing burst into five lights, you know. And then after he got done telling me the story, I said to him, well, geez, what did you think about that? Did that change your life? He goes, I could give a crap. He absolutely doesn't care at all. He said, I never even think about it. I just think about it once in a while. But everyone else that I've ever spoke to on this show or anywhere else has definitely come up with how this has totally changed her life, and it changed mine totally when I saw something I couldn't explain. It made me really think about it. So far in your, this is a hard topic to research, I would think. And can you just give a couple of examples of what you're running into?
Yeah, sure. I mean, to date, I think I've realistically interviewed probably about 80 or so individuals. Again, running the spectrum from sightings to abductions and everything in between, whether it's high strangeness or close encounters. And the only problems I'm running into right now at this point is I have too much material. It's really narrowing in on not so much an angle, but what I really want to convey is the individual and, again, how the event affected them and how it's changed them. I think that's what is most important is I'm looking for how these events are changing us as human beings. And, you know, later in the book, I do dive into what is reality, what is consciousness, what is awareness, and how this can play a part in what the sighting may or may not have been. But, yeah, I'm interviewing people from all over the world. So a few of the challenges I've run into is literally, you know, things getting lost in translation, whether it's certain terms or culturally. Again, we often look at this phenomenon in a very Western-centric view because that's what we're used to. But this phenomenon is not, it doesn't seem to be biased. It seems to be happening all over the world to all different types of people, whether it's gender or religion. It's affecting everyone on a grand scale. And now it's really trying to find a through line there and find the connections between these people and how that might help us evolve and might bring us closer to the phenomenon. It's almost like an intersection, and we're trying to get there. And yeah, it's been very exciting, very frustrating at times, but I can see the light at the end of the tunnel, and yeah, very excited.
It's hard to put something like this together now when you're looking for these people to talk to. How I know is it seems like there's a really big network for, say, experiencers.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and that seems like a no-brainer to be able to get people to talk about that. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to other, you know, like you said, high strangeness or sightings or encounters, how do you find your people when it comes to that?
Mm-hmm. A lot of it has come from networking. I've reached out to, you know, I've been lucky to be one of the one from the generation of social networking. I got in on the tail end of that. So I will say Facebook has been a godsend for me. Just to reach out to people.
There's a lot on Facebook. You know,
yes.
We have 20 some odd thousand likes on our Facebook page, mm-hmm. but we didn't start that but just a few years ago. And I think it was actually a former guest was on Christina that suggested, you know, you should try Facebook. That's where I get all my contacts.
Yeah, I cannot tell you how many friends I've made through that. And conferences like this, meeting people and going to the experiencer sessions in the morning and, you know, hesitantly approaching certain people afterwards and be like, would you be willing to come forward and share your story?
Now, do yeah. most of the people want to be anonymous, or some people actually would give their full name?
I've actually made a promise to myself that I want to put faces to the names. I don't want pseudonyms. I only want people who are willing to back up their story with who they are as the individual. Again, that's what I'm trying to focus on is the person.
That makes a lot of sense because I was just watching, for instance, the other day, I don't know how I stumbled across a documentary of Linda Moulton Howe, who someone was talking about earlier, our guest actually in the room was talking about what a wonderful interviewer she is. Mm-hmm. She really is. She's great with questions. And she was interviewing a ex-CIA agent, NSA. He was blacked out and anonymous. And he was talking about, you know, the aliens and actually meeting and talking to these aliens and all that. And, you know, if what he said was real. It was totally amazing. But here's a total anonymous person. And to me, I watched something like that, and it's an interesting story. And that's as far as I go with it.
That's very true. It's a struggle. Part of me understands that sometimes the story is more important than the person. But at the same time, again, like you said, at that point, it is just a story. It's just hearsay. It's just one person's testimony. And again, we can only take their word for it. But when I think these individuals are willing to maybe put their reputation on the line or come forward and be brave enough to say, this is who I am. I'm a doctor. I'm a police officer. You know, I'm a teacher, and this happened to me. Again, I understand the ridicule factor that comes with all this, the stigma that we all face on a day-to-day basis. But I think the more we can accept that this is happening, the easier it's going to become for more people to come forward.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh, we just had someone pop in. I think he's going to say hello to us, perhaps. And we have a hardworking man here today putting together quite a show. Yes, we're live, sir.
You got online and you're live.
We're live. Go ahead, Alejandro.
All right, so I get to talk to Ryan Sprague, one of my favorite.
Oh, people. I've been talking too much.
Oh, really? Hopefully good stuff. Is he saying, I'm telling all the behind the scenes?
Not
it
yet.
They look so
no.
organized, but these guys are morons.
They have
oh
no
gosh.
Idea what they're doing.
Yeah, well, cool. I'm glad you were able to get online and do it live. I feel like a diva being able to come in and get handed the microphone. What are you doing? You're tripping over wires over there.
Yes.
So, I guess just talk about the conference. I mean, the days.
Yeah, I went over today who we had. But yeah, do you have any initial thoughts on today or where we're headed?
I mean, I think everybody was really good. Everybody was better than I don't know if I'd say better than expected, but one of the things that we do with this conference is we bring in people who aren't necessarily in the circuit. We don't know if they're going to be fantastic or what, but they're people we know have some good material. And, you know, luckily today we had a lot of really good speakers,
mm-hmm.
very professional and energetic and with great information. And even some of the speakers, I won't say who for their sake, sometimes are not seasoned speakers and they're super nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So they end up doing a great job. You know, last year, Robert Schroeder, have you had him?
There
on the
you
show?
Go. There's the key word. That was the propulsion specialist. Yeah.
I was talking about propulsion or how, you know,
He was a great example. He was hilarious because he was so nervous and he comes to the conference. He said he wanted to do a talk. He sent me a PowerPoint. It looked great. I had interviewed him. And so he came to the conference and I knew it was a gamble. And he was like, when he got here, he's like, I'm not a very good speaker. I'm really nervous. I don't know if I'm going to do very good. And I was like, oh, great. Now you tell me. But he did great. He was so likable, and people loved him. And now,
they really do.
Know,
he's a real gentleman. And I've noticed at conferences I've seen him speak at that right after he speaks, people surround him. You know?
Yeah. So this is an example of this. Today felt like we had a few of those, which is always really cool. So I always hope that, you know, these people with their great info get to be the people who get invited to conferences, like what's happened with Schroeder, and they get to be the guys invited to podcasts and talk to you. Because not all podcasts are as forward-looking as you all, and, you know, getting guests out there who aren't maybe as well-known but have some great information.
Yeah, that's great. It must be hard for you, Alejandro, or whoever it is that coordinates the speakers on trying to pick. You must have to do this like years in advance or at least a year in advance, something like that. And, you know, do you just go through like a list of, okay, this person was here 2 years ago, we're going to skip him for now, and, you know.
We do that. We try not to bring back the same person twice in a row. The only person who has that ability is Jaime Musan, and that's partially because the owner was good friends with him and and he's always been a UFO Congress staple.
Oh, every year?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Like for, I don't know, probably for 10 years. So that's a big reason. Otherwise, yeah, it's trying not to get the same people as last year, as well as a huge list of people who want to talk that are on the list who have offered to talk. and a combination of trying to add in what's new, what's going on right now. And it is kind of a bummer because we start on our list. We'll start on our list next week after this conference of who's going to speak. And we have that worked out so early that it is, you know, because we're day by day news, of course, as you know, we talk weekly, that, you know, it's always like, oh man, cause this is hot right now. It's too bad we don't have this person, on. So,
I'm going to put you on the spot. Do you have one news story you can talk about real quickly?
One news story.
Podesta, whatever his name is.
Oh yeah, I could talk about Podesta, and that this is debatable.
Podesta, yeah.
So Podesta is into UFOs. We know this. He spoke at a press conference. It was part of the Sci-Fi Channel, and it was also sponsored by Leslie Kane and her Citizens for Citizens for Not Keeping Secrets or something like something similar, but more, much more intelligently named than that. But so, yeah, he went to this press conference and said, you know, we need an end to UFO secrecies. We should release all of the files. It's well known he was an X-Files fan. He had like an X-Files birthday party at the White House when he was working for the Clintons. So it's known that he's a UFO Gaia enthusiast. And so he just tweeted the other day. Now, this is the part people are leaving out, I think. He tweeted to a New York Times writer. The New York Times is often seen as being kind of, I think, conservative, you know. Or is that more Washington Post? I'm getting confused now. But anyways, he sent it to a writer that, you know, his number one was regret with it that he didn't release the UFO files or get them released. So a lot of people are jumping on this and thinking, oh, my gosh. The UK Mirror did a terrible story where they wrote that that he regretted not being able to release that the White House knows that the extraterrestrials are talking to us and stuff like that. Just totally mistranslating what the tweet said. But
not even close. I mean,
yeah, not even close. It's sensationalizing and just inaccurate. It's just pathetic as far as journalism goes. But the big question is, was he joking or not? He gets teased a lot about being a UFO guy. And he is a very politically savvy person. He's probably going to be running Hillary Clinton's campaign for presidency, or at least play a role. They're thinking he'll run it. So was he just kidding around, you know, because he gets kidded around about UFOs? Leslie Kane thinks so because she says he has that sort of dry sense of humor. That's kind of what I suspect, but I don't know that that really is his number one regret, although it may be on his list somewhere.
You know, probably he's probably laughing about this whole thing right now.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. That's probably what it's all about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it's getting some play.
Jokes on us.
And maybe that's what he wanted. I mean, he's a politically savvy person. Maybe he just wanted to create just get his name out there and get the Hillary campaign out there a bit. That could be. I think there's probably some method to the madness of the tweet.
That would be interesting if, you know, they're backing off, say, Hillary happens to win or something, and then the UFO topic is once again explored.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It could be him playing with the idea. I don't know that the UFO topic is politically dangerous when it comes to mainstream and it comes to the media because they treat it so tongue-in-cheek. But there are many issues that the media and the public don't see eye to eye on. I mean, if you look at issues that science and politics kind of collide with, like environmental issues and global warming, you know, scientists in the media are saying, hey, global warming's a real deal. Whereas, obviously, the Republicans feel that they're getting some political play by fighting that whole concept. So it could be, I kind of was brainstorming, what if Podesta thinks that there is some political, you know, energy here that can be gained from being kind of pro-UFO? Maybe he's trying to get that segment. And there's no doubt that UFO stories are really popular, and there's a segment of maybe, you know, don't think it would be unfair to say at least a quarter, maybe a third of the population that are really into the topic. So maybe he's trying to plug in and kind of keep those people in tow to vote Hillary in 2016.
It may, Yeah, I'm wondering what the percentage actually is that are into UFOs. I would guess it would be more like 10% myself, but you never know.
But
I think
the popularity of the shows.
Yeah, but also I think it's growing.
Yeah.
You know, with more discoveries of lifelike planets out there, and more people are just becoming more comfortable with it. And I think yes, it will be growing. So, maybe that's a part that no one's ever thought of politically,
Yeah, yeah. I think Podesta's thought of it. I'm sure he has. And maybe others have. I mean, it came into politics with Kucinich when he ran for president, and it came up for him. And a lot of people credit that whole UFO thing, people talking about his UFO sighting kind of tanking his chances for presidency. Although I think a lot of people would still acknowledge that he was a long shot in the first place.
So. Mm-hmm. So what would you do, Alejandro, if tonight all of a sudden the Phoenix Lights reappears and it's right over the casino here, big triangle?
Happened a couple weeks ago and the news came and I said there was flares. Because it was. No, but if it was a real triangle?
Yeah, I mean,
I would love that. And this is really funny because I have a friend at this conference and she believes she can channel. And she channeled for us and my mom was there. My mom was living out here for a little while, and she said next March it's going to happen again, the channeler. And my mom was so excited, and she was getting ready for it because she was dying to see the Phoenix Lights. And then it didn't happen, and she was really bummed out about the whole thing. So
it's kind of like the Mayan calendar, off it a little bit maybe.
Yeah, and I had a little bit of that, back there. That would be really cool. I hope it does happen. I would love to see that myself, of course, being a researcher and everything.
Well, it was good. Dr. Lynn Katai was here today briefly.
Yeah.
And
she'll probably be back. She's.
Yeah. But we're right here. I mean, it's not. How far away did that actually happen from right where we are?
Well, there weren't sightings, I don't believe, on this side of town. There might have been because there was a lot over but it was mostly on the other side of town, and it went from Needles, California, kind of where the conference used to be, the Laughlin area, down to Tucson.
So it's actually following where the conference goes? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Extraterrestrials like to buzz where this conference is. And why not? It's the biggest one. It'd be nice of them. Super Bowl, they fly the stealth bomber over it. So every UFO Congress, the aliens should do a flyover.
I think so.
You
keep it going.
Celebrate the event.
Now, I think Roger Lear,
Dr. Lear.
Dr. Lear mentioned that a conference in Europe he was at, that they went outside and everyone saw all these sightings.
Yeah, and I've heard those stories before too, and it could happen. I mean, that would be neat if it did. I know I was at a conference where that happened, and luckily some people on the street saw big crowds of people going outside, and they had binoculars. They happened to have binoculars, and it was balloons, unfortunately, but because, people are really into UFOs. But I think this is a really interesting story that way. It's an Alan Hynek story. He was at a conference for astronomers, and somebody comes in and says, there's UFOs outside. And Hynek's like, really? And so, but nobody went outside to look. Everybody laughed. And so he scolded them, I guess, in his talk. And he said, you guys say you're open to it. And if you had a chance to examine or research it, you would look. But you don't. When it happened, not one of you got up to walk outside to even take a look to see what it was. So he really scolded them and just kind of emphasized what his argument was, is that they're not willing to take a look and give it a fair shake, and that if they were, they would find it's much more interesting than they assume.
Wow, that's cool nothing. Story. No story I ever heard before.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. So are you happy with it? It seems like there's a lot of people here. Is it average or?
There's a lot of people, and the vendor room is thoroughly packed, but the way I usually feel about this, especially with when the conference ends at its climax, because it ends on the weekend when it's the biggest, busiest. So when the last conference ended, everything was crazy packed. And although everybody comes up and, oh my gosh, there's so many people, I always feel like, well, you haven't seen nothing yet. Mm-hmm. So even though there's a lot of people, which is great, our numbers are up.
Your Saturday lineup, I know, is wonderful.
Saturday's like a Comic-Con. It's really so packed. It's like shoulder to shoulder.
And I'm not going to be around, unfortunately. Yeah. I told you the story about clicking the wrong button when I was buying my ticket in it was a terrible mess.
After you told that story, we had a lot of cancellations. They're like,
I'm sure that happened.
I don't care about Lazara. Yeah. I wanted to see Martin.
They actually, just a quick story to the listening audience. I clicked on a ticket to come out here. I had so many days out here. And then below it, it said, save, so, you know, $100-something. So I said, oh, that looks good. So and I looked, and it's two stops, just like the other one. So, I mean, one layover. So I clicked on it, and then I found out the other day that I would be flying back in 11 hours after I landed. So in other words, I was going to be coming in last night and leaving this morning. Then the only thing left was first class tickets and on and on and on. So it's been a total nightmare, and I feel like shouting out the name of the ticket company, because I called them and I said, you know, you shouldn't have, I picked my time already. Yeah. You shouldn't have like that, you know, click for a cheaper ticket below. So. Yeah. Here I am being cheap with listeners' money that helped me get out here. So sorry about that. But anyway, I was going to ask Robert, are you want to hang in for a little while?
No, I probably should run. I hate to
come in. Pop no, in thanks for popping in.
I feel like a diva or something. But
no,
thank you so much.
You bet. And
but I mean, I was.
And we'll be talking to you next week.
Braving the forest of Arizona for you with my cell phone before.
That's
so
right.
I don't need to apologize for you.
That's right.
I've risked my life for this.
You
show.
Did. Yeah. There's puma out there, right?
There's bears.
Are there bears?
Yeah, and there are llama too. That we're at a
killer llama.
Not too far.
Really?
I don't know if they're killers. They look pretty mean.
Yeah.
But if one of those would have gotten loose and I ran into that in the dark, would have been pretty scary.
Yeah. See those big lips coming right at you?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All right. See you guys. Have fun.
Yeah. Hey, thanks, Alejandro. So we're getting back to Robert Farrell. I wanted you to, Robert, when you and I had our conversation way, way back in the beginning of this podcast, I think you were like guest number 4 or 5. You were early on.
Uh-huh.
Can you explain a little bit about your book? Because I think it's been long enough that the listener hasn't heard you talk about it. And I'd like to... you to explain, if I remember right, and tell me if I'm wrong, there was some type of, it was almost like using gravity or something.
Oh, yes, it was.
Yeah, why don't you go ahead and talk, first of all, the name of your book, is it still available?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's called The Science Behind Alien Encounters, and I'm getting a spinoff from that book that I'll be coming out with soon, actually called The Science Behind Gravitational Field Propulsion, subtitle, Key to Interstellar Travel. And that's spun off of the first book, because I do talk about how I feel they propel themselves. And in my lecture and in the book, I start off by presenting the theoretical reasons that support that you actually can create gravitational fields. Einstein knew that there was a relationship between gravitational fields and electromagnetic fields. And it's a matter of knowing how to manipulate them to create a gravitational field. And so I talk about the theoretical part. I even talk about some papers that have been presented, peer-reviewed papers at the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, for instance. Then I also talk about what's being done in the laboratory. And one of the more interesting experiments was done by Dr. Eugene Podkletnov. And he's a Russian, but he works in Finland. His expertise is primarily materials. He is developing superconducting materials. And through serendipity, they were testing this superconductor, and they noticed a strange effect that when someone walked into the room that was smoking a pipe, the smoke kind of came over and went straight up from the spinning superconductor. And they said, uh-huh. Well, then they experimented further, and they suspended a weight over this thing, and they noticed that there was a weight reduction. Now, so they did actually publish a paper in 1992. I think the title was something like The Shielding of Gravity by Superconductors. That's how they presented it, that they weren't creating gravity, they were shielding gravity. He went on from that, serendipity, to develop a special machine where he can generate gravitational pulses. And I talk about that as well. He's able to create a pulse that can bend a 2-inch thick piece of steel or thinner material. He can punch a hole in it. But some of the interesting things that kind of defy the physics that I learned is, number one, he measured the energy that these pulses distribute whenever they go through and whatever they dissipate. But he found out that the energy dissipated by these things is greater than the energy he puts into the machine. And he claims he's not a theoretical physicist, but he thinks maybe it has something to do with the subatomic particles somehow releasing energy. Maybe it has something to do with zero-point energy that people talk about. Another thing that he pointed out, which I found amazing, was even though this thing can bend a metal plate in front of it, there is no reaction on his machine. And I always learned action, reaction. Apparently that's not true when you're dealing with gravity. The third thing that I found really interesting, he measured the speed of this pulse, this gravity wave. And if you ask a physicist, you know, how fast does gravity travel, most of them will shrug their shoulders, or they might say, oh, probably speed of light. Well, he found out it goes 64 times the speed of light.
Now, is this in particular documented anywhere? Like, for instance, say a listener's listening right now, can they find something up about this information?
Well, that was on the website where I found that. And I'm trying to remember the website. It had to do with a gravity website where they were dealing with different forms of gravity propulsion.
But when they were doing something like this, did they scientifically go through this and peer review it and all that, do you know? Or is it more loose than that?
The paper that he presented as far as the shielding of gravity was peer-reviewed and presented, I believe, at the AIAA. Then he went on to develop this machine that I told you about. And more recently, he claims that he's produced the machine that does continuously produces gravity by a spinning magnetic field. And he has gone silent since then.
Oh, really?
last time I communicated with him, he was looking for financing.
Funding,
so,
yeah.
Yeah. So
if it's something, that seems like something that he would almost easily get funding for if he's actually made a breakthrough like that.
Unless somebody doesn't want it on the market. I don't know. You never know.
For whatever reason, yeah.
Yeah. Because Boeing and NASA were very interested in his initial results. Mm-hmm. They did studies of their own to confirm them, but then they kind of went away. Now, why did they go away? Maybe they wanted to keep going, but they didn't want the public to know what they were doing. So there's always that issue about, you know, the guy that invented the carburetor that gets 50 miles per gallon.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? The oil company bought it from him. So
yes.
That kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do believe that stuff does happen.
Yeah.
I really do. I think,
oh, yeah.
You know, whenever, you know, like for instance, the paint roller, you know, you take a paint roller and you roll your walls. That was suppressed for 30 years.
Oh, I didn't know
by
that.
Brush companies.
Yeah.
Yeah. So these things, these type of things do happen.
Yeah. But there's been other experiments in the lab where they've actually generated gravity. I don't recall the name of the lab right offhand. I should have prepared myself. But it was a device where they had these magnetic rollers that were spinning. And when they'd spin the thing up to a certain speed, they didn't put any energy into it and it would keep spinning. And if they spun it up faster, it would actually create and generate energy. Not only that, but the weight of the device went down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they reverse the direction of it, then the weight went up. So they were creating, in one case, a negative gravitational field that was subtracting the weight, and in another case, a positive field.
Yeah.
And I go through a number of instances in the laboratory where they are creating gravitational fields.
Uh-huh. Now, one of the things I do remember, it was kind of fascinating when you were talking about it, was when someone is actually, and I have some friends that do parachuting,
yeah,
for instance, when they jump out of the plane, they don't really feel like they're falling. It's just a different thing. It's different when you can see something beside you and,
right,
and all that. I guess that's what it is. But if I remember right, it was almost like their propulsion is like almost like falling in a way.
One of the things I discussed was
Because I say, well, okay, suppose we can create gravitational field propulsion. What good is it? And how does it allow crafts like UFOs to do 100G accelerations without hurting the occupants? Because, as you know, our pilots can only go maybe 10 Gs at most, and then they have problems.
Right.
I don't think there's any limit as to how many Gs a UFO can go, but they've been clocked at 100 Gs.
Yeah.
And so the way I explain that is I say, well, if they have gravitational field propulsion, they can do that. Any other kind of field propulsion probably wouldn't allow them to do that, but gravity field would. So the analogy that I gave is if I put somebody in a rocket and I fire them off in a rocket and I'm talking with them with my little walkie-talkie or maybe something different today, but and they would take off and I would say, well, now what's happening? And they would say, well, I'm experiencing 4 Gs. I'm being held down in my couch and I can hardly move. So I'm watching and I'm watching and it gets up to a certain height and the flames sputter out. And I say, well, now what's happening? And they say, well, I'm kind of trying to float out of my couch and G meter says zero. And I keep watching and then all of a sudden it starts coming down again. And I say, okay, now what's happening? Oh, nothing's changed. It's still 0 Gs and I tend to float out of my couch. And I said, well, but did you realize you're accelerating at 1 G? And if we had done this on Jupiter, you'd be accelerating at 40 Gs, but you'd have no sensation. And so that's the thing. If you create a gravitational field as a means of propulsion, whether it's positive or negative, you free fall into it or away from it. It's a free falling thing, and you have no sensation. You could do 100 Gs, 1,000 Gs, or whatever. And the beauty, if you could build a craft like the UFO that can do 100 Gs, you could get to the moon in 18 minutes.
Not
you know, being
bad.
On space yeah. has no problem at all. And you could go to Mars, I think, I figured, in 12 hours.
Uh-huh.
And so the issue of the effects of zero gravity on our astronauts is no longer an issue because they're only out there, you know, 12 hours.
If you think about it, the beauty of this is if it can be theorized, then someday it can probably happen. You know, and
yeah.
it's something that we can probably use, like you say.
Yeah.
So this is great. I just want to say a few people just walked into the room. I'm excited to say we have Linda Zimmerman, and we have Kathleen Martin, and we have Stanton T. Friedman all sitting here. And we're going to have what we call a little round robin here. So I'd like first, Linda, if we can introduce yourself. I'm going to have you on for a full show on the show coming up at some point. But I really, really enjoyed your talk today. Can you just give a nutshell of what you talked about?
Thank you. Yes, I was talking about the history of UFO sightings in the Hudson Valley of New York, which is essentially from New York City up to Albany and spans at least 100 years. So a lot longer than most people realize. A lot of them just see the Hudson Valley experience as the giant triangles of the 80s and 90s. So I was just trying to show it's much more expansive than that.
Now, they go back to, let me just ask you this. Were people seeing before the dirigibles and the balloons? Now, they had balloons in the Civil War. You know, I mean, they were not so good. And I think they had a poisonous gas. Probably, Stan, you probably know what the gas is they used in them. But they were very, very dangerous. But, you know, they were actively used in the Civil War. They used to spy, you know, by using that, which is something that not a lot of people know about. It's not talked about a lot. But so before humans, let's say, you say this only goes back 100 years. But I could have sworn I heard you say that even earlier there were some noted sightings, or was that someone else who was talking about that?
There was somebody who was talking about colonial era sightings.
Yeah.
But getting to the balloons or dirigibles in 1909, when they were being seen at night, they were flying at a very high rate of speed, and the best dirigible we had at that point could go maybe 20 miles an hour for a duration of an hour. And these were seen hovering and moving extremely rapidly for as long as 4 hours at a time. So we did not have lighter than aircraft that could follow those characteristics and carry big bright lights on them as well.
Mm-hmm. Now there was, I think I heard you say today that there were some of these sightings that had thousands of people witness them. Can you talk a little bit about that?
During the early 1980s, the massive triangle sightings, it was estimated that in one period of time, perhaps a year, there were at least 25,000 people. And those were people who reported it to the police. You know, not that things were written up or followed up on, but at least 25,000 people called someone to report their sightings. So how many more didn't bother to respond? So
now, when we go back into some of these earlier sightings before the, say, the Robertson panel or something like that, do you hear, is there like ridicule? They say, you know, these people are crazy, or is there any of that type of stuff apparent in any of these reports that you've been reading?
Ridicule seems to be as old as UFO sightings. Mm-hmm. The 1909 sightings, people were doing cartoons and major newspapers saying that, oh, people must have seen Santa Claus flying through the air, and already making for all the elements of the demeaning the witness were there 100 years ago.
Really? Yeah. Yeah. So just since we have, this is awesome, we have Travis Walton just walked in. And so we have, look at this nice full panel. And I'm going to take a little bit of a video that will be up on the website so you can see everyone here. If you don't mind, I'm going to pass this over for a minute to the mic. If you wouldn't mind passing that over to Kathleen Martin to say hi. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello.
And it was so nice to see you. I seem to run into you all the time at conferences everywhere.
We do run into each other quite often, don't we, at conferences.
Yeah. So what's going on with you? It sounded to me today when we talked briefly that your title changed a little bit for MUFON, or is it basically the same?
We decided to change the title from the abduction research team to the experiencer research team. The reason for that is that I had a lot of complaints over a number of years about the word abduction, because it implied that it was a negative experience. And some people were saying, well, I don't view my experience as being negative. And you know, other people tried to convince me to use the word contact or contactee. But to me, that implies a positive experience. Going back to the 50s, contactees. So John Mack came up with the term experiencer. It seems to be more of a generic term that applies to anyone who believes they've had this kind of experience. So we went with the word experiencer.
Uh-huh.
So I hope people
are
happy, but I have already received a complaint saying, Why do you want to blur the lines here? Why don't we call it abduction again?
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
You know, so you can't make everybody happy.
It's like the UAP and UFO, and you know, I mean, there's is it? I'm trying to think who it is. Is it Richard Haynes that doesn't like to use the word UFO? Just like it's a bad thing, you know, and it can be, you know, conjured as a bad thing because of you know, the way a lot of society looks at it. So there was one other thing you and I were talking about. So you're getting contacted, sort of organically. People are reaching out to you from all over, you said, from Italy, Poland, places like that.
Yes.
So how does that happen? They just find you on the internet and...
Oftentimes they find me on the internet. They've maybe heard me on a radio show, or also MUFON is expanding quite a lot now around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm MUFON's international and national as well, director of experiencer research. So they might have heard my name through MUFON as well.
Okay, now we're going to say hi to Stanton. And I'm just hoping the microphone cord reaches over there.
It seems to.
Yeah. How you doing, Stanton?
I'm doing very well, thanks.
Hey, you look pretty good. You look like you're in good health these days. How are you feeling?
I am. I mean, so I had a heart attack. Lots of people
I know,
had heart attacks.
Are you tired of people asking you that?
Not really, because there have been some strange stories out there where some people were told that I had passed away.
I heard that. Yeah.
And I told them rumors of my death are greatly exaggerated, as Mark Twain said. Others have had me having, you know, being in poor health, and so forth. And, you know, I had a heart attack. I had two stents put in. I spent a few days in the hospital being bored stiff. And,
yeah.
And that was it. And I've gone about my life, and I've driven and lectured and flown. And
You're glad to get out of where you're living right now with the snow, aren't you?
I tell you, if I had a choice of places to be, I'd much rather be here than back in Fredericton, where it was 10 below the other day and where there's 4 feet of snow on the front lawn. And I say lawn in quotes. You can't see anything green. So I'm here. I've got a talk in San Diego next week, too.
Oh, really? So are you staying here and then going over to San Diego? Or?
Yes.
All right.
I don't get home until next, a week from Thursday. So
you're a smart man, Stan.
Well, lucky. Arranged everything, of course. It just happened that way.
Perfect. So how do you think this seems like it's a great conference. How do you think it's going?
Well, I haven't had much chance to see how it's
going. Oh, that's
going.
Right. You've people been in the vendor room, right?
I've been in the vendor room, and people all want to talk to me, and they all want to ask me how I am. And I get a lot of thank yous for all I've contributed, which just reflects how old I am and how long I've been around.
Yeah.
So I haven't really heard any of the speakers yet. There is one event, two events I have to participate in. One is that I will be in the last panel on Sunday, the last event of the conference, as an invited guest. And it's talking about whistleblowers.
Hmm.
And I'm a little concerned. One of the people on the panel is Pocklington, I think that's his name, who did Mirage Men.
Oh,
I
yes.
read his book, mm-hmm. and I watched the movie, and I think he's all wrong when it comes to the abduction phenomenon and all this stuff that he's saying government intelligence agencies are creating all this stuff as mythology. But he's got so many mistakes, so many factual errors, and so many things he's ignored. For example, he blames Roswell on the Aztec story, which makes no sense at all,
mm-hmm.
and he hasn't done his homework.
Mm.
So that's one event. It'll be interesting for me. The other is...
Tear them apart.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah.
The other is that George Knapp is giving a talk, and then mm-hmm. afterward he's interviewing Bob Lazar on stage.
Right.
And I had
Know about... I remember you and I talking about you doing the research on his schooling background.
Well, not only his... Well, primarily his schooling background, yes. And I found he wasn't telling the truth. I talked to his high school, for goodness sakes. He was in the bottom third of his high school class. And you don't get into MIT with that. Nobody. I talked to five different people at MIT, and none of them ever heard of him. And I talked to a legal counsel who said there's no way to erase his records. Once you're in the system, you're in the system. And, of course, MIT was doing classified research back in the 40s. So it's not just... You know, it has to do with the government kind of thing. They're a pretty independent group at MIT.
Now, let me ask you something, Stan. Are you actually going to ask
I don't know. That's why I'm going there to see what they'll let me say. I have no
idea.
Take
your heart medicine first. Just to be,
say what?
Take your heart medicine first just in case.
Well, look, I tried to meet with Bob back 25 years ago. I was here when in Las Vegas when George originally talked about the story. And because I'm a nuclear physicist and I was being asked about this young nuclear physicist, I figured I ought to check things out because I don't want to reflect badly on the trade, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I kept coming up negative.
Mm.
And so I have trouble believing what somebody says. If you can't believe what he says about himself, why should I believe anything else? There's no doubt Bob is a bright young, well, he's not so young anymore, but neither am I, guy. But is he telling the truth? That's what
it's kind of, you know, and what I do for work is fine arts and things like that. And it's kind of like if there's a fake in the bunch, then you have to look them all over. You know, I mean, you have to very carefully examine this person new. If this person is selling a fake, then it kind of loses the whole, you know, the whole credibility thing. So I understand where this is going.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that because it's a point I've tried to make to people to switch the subject over to MJ-12. If you're going to make a fraud, I don't know what the right term is these days, you want to do as little as possible to call attention to it. Nothing out of the way.
That's right.
Stick to the procedures that went with the person you're trying to emulate or whatever you're doing. And what I recently did in two articles for the MUFON Journal is, in one, list a dozen arguments that have been made against the MJ-12 documents, showed that none of them stand up. They hadn't done their homework. And the other was, there's a whole bunch of stuff that we didn't know to be true that turned out to be true well after we got the documents. How did the person know? Psychic faker? Psychic hoaxer? What is it? Just to give one example, the date of one of the important items is the only date in an eight-month period where President Truman met with James Forrestal and Vannevar Bush at the same time. And the memo is from Truman to Forrestal and naming Bush within the text. And that's the only date in an eight-month period where those three met together. And I asked the Truman Library whether anybody else had ever asked the question. No. There are some strange, the date is not continuous on it. September and then the 1947 is at an angle to it. It obviously had been in a typewriter twice. Now, why would anybody faking a document do that? You don't want to call attention to that.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a number of other items like that. And I always remember what Bud Hopkins told me about artists faking, you know, artwork of some known artist.
They always want to make it very, very similar. A lot of times they'll, just for instance, they'll find a painting that's already painted that looks just like an artist's work, but of course it's not a valuable artist, and then they'll just, it mysteriously gets the artist's name put on it, you know, so it's along the same lines.
But you don't do anything to call attention.
Right. It's it has to be close.
I think that's true with documents, too.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, you know, here I am, a physicist, getting into artwork and stuff like that. But it's kind of fun. And there's a real challenge here. I feel that people have a responsibility, if they're going to claim to be researchers, to do their homework.
Yeah.
One just to pick one thing. I made a point about Dr. Donald Menzel being a member of this MJ-12 group. Everybody knew he was a total debunker. He'd written three debunking books. How could he know about a crash saucer, alien bodies, et cetera? Well, I got permission from three different people to see his papers at Harvard. People complain, and I found to my total astonishment, because I didn't like the man when he was alive, that he told Jack Kennedy he had a longer continuous association with the National Security Agency and Navy intelligence of anybody in the country. Nobody knew that.
Hmm.
And so how did they know that? But knowing other people who say he couldn't have led a double life, and I would point to some spies who have nicely led double lives, Burgess, Philby, and McLean, and England, and so forth. But none of them have gone to Harvard to look at the papers. Well, darn it, if you're going to say it isn't true, check it out. You know, don't just say, well, I know it can't be, so I'm just going to say it isn't. Travis, you've had the same problem.
Here.
Haven't you, with people making claims where they don't know what
they're talking about? Oh, yeah, you know, that people, you know, just make something, they can't back it up, and, you know, it's pretty easy to just blow them out of the water when you produce, and you can direct people to the original source for the, you know, authentic information.
Yeah, and that's what we have to do. We in ufology have to police our sightings, if you will, by checking out the facts. I found somebody who worked for Truman the entire time he was at the White House and asked his opinion about the documents after sending them and stuff like that. Nobody else has done that.
How long ago was that?
More than 10 years. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I've been to the presidential libraries, and I find they're very valuable, and the people are very helpful. And, well, as another example, every top secret document has to have a top secret control number, I was told by several people. I'd already published a couple that didn't, that I know are genuine because they came from the archives. So I asked the archivist, we have loads of top secret documents without top secret control numbers on them. But nobody bothers to check that. They know because when they worked at a certain office at a certain time, all our documents had top secret control number. Well, to generalize that to everybody is ridiculous. Are there phony abduction experiencer stories? Of course. Does that mean everybody who claims one is lying? Of course not. So there's some rules for the game, and they don't seem to be being adhered to by people who attack.
Sam, can you think of another question to ask Travis since you have the microphone?
You looking forward to the movie?
Yeah, that will be the first time I've seen it.
Well, I haven't seen it yet.
I'm supposed to introduce it, but I haven't even seen the trailer for it yet. So I don't know whether to say, rah, 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 this is great or not. I'll know after I watch it.
That's Friday night.
Friday.
Friday night, 7 o'clock.
Yes,
somewhere.
Friday at 7.
I don't know where.
Well, you know, a lot went into this production. It was quite a bit of in-depth research. You know, a lot of people that were very hard to get a hold of were interviewed. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, there's a pretty wide, comprehensive amount of content there. And how it was all edited together and whether it would just be exactly the way I would do it, I'm waiting to see. But
I'm looking forward to it because I think they're going to use a few minutes from my movie, UFOs Are Real, because I interviewed him back when he was a young man. I was younger, too.
Stan Friedman was one of the first researchers to actually visit the area and the site.
And talk to the people.
He does his homework.
Travis, in the movie Fire in the Sky, for instance, there is a ufologist that, you know, I don't even know if any of this is accurate, but there's a ufologist that is, like, waiting to see you and puts a lot of pressure on you. Was that real? And if so, do you want to talk about who that was?
Well, that scene doesn't depict a particular incident that actually occurred, but there was quite a bit of back and forth between the various organizations, some of which don't exist anymore. But In my mind, I associate that scene mostly with a now defunct organization called Ground Saucer Watch that all of the people in there with a little research uncovered that they had, to put it mildly, exaggerated their credentials.
Yeah, well, that's true. And I checked on one of them who claimed a degree from a certain school and he didn't have one. I'm fond of checking on people that strike me as not telling the truth about their academic background. That's one of the things that'll come up about Lazar. I hope I get a chance to express my
I hope you do too. And unfortunately, I won't be here to actually see that, but I know they'll have the DVD and, you know, they'll be recording it. But yeah, I would, I think Bob Lazar is a very bright person,
I've said so
like
many
you say,
times.
And everything. I mean, he's sharp. The story is a little. You know, I mean, it'll be interesting to hear, you know, what he has to say after all this time. And I think, you know, the question and answer part is going to be the cream of the crop. Right.
Are you
there.
Sure they're going to have one?
I would think so. I mean, they're supposed to have one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Can Stan, can you go into a little more about when you researched Travis's case since it was so early on? I just never heard that before.
Well, of course, I'd heard the noise, and I talked to the people at APRO, which doesn't exist anymore, Coral and Jim Lorenzen, to get their findings. And I also talked to Jim Harder, Dr. James Harder from University of California, Berkeley, who did the, was that the only hypnosis?
Yes, that's the only hypnosis.
Yeah, and I've known Jim Harder and for quite a long time. He's gone too now, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
But, and so after talking to the people, I was working on the movie UFOs Are Real, and I wanted to use this as one of the cases. We traveled across the country. We talked to Harder in Berkeley going up. There's a way to get up to his house in the Berkeley Hills on a sort of a tramway, which is kind of different. We talked to Betty Hill, talked to Jesse Marcel down in the Louisiana, talked to several other prominent people, Marjorie Fish with the Betty Hill Star Map, Dr. Mitchell, of the Ohio State University Astronomy Department, who had some strong things to say about the accuracy of Marjorie's work. And so we went to people who were directly involved in cases. And Travis's case was good because there were several people involved. We talked to Mike Rogers, too. And because we went out to the actual location, so you could get a feeling for what the area was like. That part of Arizona is a little bit different from New England, for example, you know, or from Ohio, where we were, and other places like that. So I was very favorably impressed with Travis. It took us a while to get there, of course, because Snowflake is not really near any large place.
It's quite a ways out of the way.
Yes. And I was, all of us, there was only a small group of us making the movie, but we were quite impressed with Travis and with Mike and with the circumstances. And as I've tried to tell people, if you go to a small town and a guy is known, you get a reputation. Everybody in town knows you. You can't hide. They'll say, oh, he's a liar, or, you know, he makes up stories all the time and so forth. And it's a little bit of that in Roswell, too, that you get a reputation. And we asked around in Snowflake. We visited Travis at his home, met his family. And Travis won't mind my saying this, I was impressed by the fact that he delivered his own children. Having been present at the birth of my daughter, that made a very favorable impression on me. And it takes somebody with a certain kind of devotion to doing the right thing. That's an awkward way of saying that. But who can be trusted with significant events. In the birth of a child, several of them, is certainly a significant event. And I don't think I've ever said that to Travis before, but I was impressed by the fact that you had delivered your kids.
Well, thank you. And, you know, I contrast your hands-on, in-person investigation with that of my critics. None of them had ever spoken to me, visited the site, or in any way done any sort of in-person, on hands-on research.
So there are different ways of doing things.
Kathy, could you tell us, did Betty Hill ever look in or talk about Travis Walton, or did that ever come up, do you know?
Yes, absolutely. Betty was asked to speak with Travis after this happened. Jim Harder, Dr. James Harder, was active in Betty's case, and also a friend of Betty by the time I met him. And Jim was talking about his investigation of Travis's case, and I happened to be at Betty's home when this was going on. Betty had already spoken to Travis, and the concern was that Betty had this experience herself. She was also a social worker, and we knew that Travis was quite shaken by this event. And so Betty was asked to speak with Travis in order to try to calm him down so that he'd have the opportunity to speak with someone who understood what he was going through, who had been through the same kind of experience himself.
And the conversation was quite effective to that end. She had some good advice. I have quite a lot of correspondence from her over the years that I want to go back and look at with fresh eyes.
And I have to tell you that Betty did not believe that everyone who thought they had been abducted actually had been, but she really did believe that Travis's event was real and that he was the real thing. Jim Harder talked about how traumatized Travis was by the event and told us about his hypnosis session with Travis I was at Betty's home.
I see. That's interesting about Betty. I never knew that she had some skepticism for other abductions. That almost gives her a little more credibility herself.
Yes, and you may not know, too, that Betty was actually an investigator for the Aerial Phenomena Research organization, APRO, after her experience. Mm-hmm. And she investigated other abductions herself.
Huh. Wow. While I have you here, I was at a conference when someone like took me to the side and was talking to me, and they said, you know that Betty and Barney Hill is, you know, a bunk, don't you? And I said, what do you have to say, you know? They said, well, there was a light on Cannon Mountain that went up in 1959 or something like that. And if you drive along, it looks like a craft, you know, being up in the mountain. And then there's a jack-o'-lantern restaurant that has a jack-o'-lantern that could look like a flying saucer landed. What about all that? I mean, did she hear that in her lifetime, or was she confronted with that?
Not in her lifetime, but I have heard it and I have read it. And I've actually even investigated it.
Uh-huh.
Because, of course, the light that was on top of Cannon Mountain was smaller in 1961 than it is today. It's been replaced. But the new investigator who has been trying to debunk all of this claimed that he went to the Mount Cleveland picnic area. And from the Mount Cleveland picnic area, he could see that light on top of Cannon Mountain. So I went to the Mount Cleveland picnic area and looked for the light at night. Couldn't find it. Couldn't see it. But I did, as I was driving toward Franconia Notch, go to the top of a hill and was able to see it very briefly from the top of the hill. Now, you have to also remember that the close encounter field was 8 miles south of Cannon Mountain, and you could not see the light at the top of Cannon Mountain from 8 miles south. And that's where the craft hovered, only 100 feet above the hill's car. And then the abduction site was about 8 miles south of there.
I see. What would you, I'm going to ask this of you, Travis, as well. I consider, you know, Travis is one of the big cases. I also think the Allagash case is pretty amazing. Are there some other, like, abductions? I know there's a lot of people that, you know, you're involved with the free thing.
Yes.
That we can talk a little bit about that. But the ones that I guess that I'm interested in right now is the cases like Travis Walton and Betty and like that. Is there any other cases in the Allagash that you can think of that really hit like the witnesses type of thing? You know, I mean, real solid, or is it all, you know, very hard to put a finger on whether it.
One of my favorite cases is from Casey County, Kentucky. Case of Mona Stafford, Yvonne's, Louise Smith, and Elaine Thomas. And this occurred in January of 1976. And it was a really good case, in my opinion. The three women knew each other, two knew each other well, another one casually. They had just gotten together for an impromptu dinner. It was one's birthday, and they had driven about, I think it was about 30 miles to a restaurant and had dinner there, did not have any alcoholic beverages. They were all interested in art. They had a good time. They turned around, and they were driving back home that night. And on the way home, they had a close encounter with a craft that came down very low over the top of their car. There was a beam of light that went into the car that caused all of them to feel very, very warm. Suddenly, the car started moving on its own. The women tried to stop it, couldn't, at about 80 miles an hour. And then all of a sudden, it stopped, and it was being pulled back in the opposite direction, almost as if they were bumping backwards over some kind of very strange highway. And, you know, you think of the Oz factor. Well, this is just really very, very strange. And the next thing they know, they're back, and they're just outside the town that they live in. And they realize that they're missing about an hour and 45 minutes that they can't account for. They go into one of the women's homes and try to decide what to do. And so they decide that they should go tell a neighbor. And the neighbor has them sit down and sketch what they saw. They all drew similar sketches. And so this was a fairly big case at that time. They didn't want to go public with it. They ended up going public because it was leaked out to a newspaper. And then some of the major organizations went in to investigate. And Dr. Leo Sprinkle went in there and did hypnosis sessions with the women. But it was a very, very interesting case. They remembered that they were taken on board a craft and that these ETs were very interested, for example, in the way their joints moved. And it reminded me of Betty and Barney in a way, because they were very interested in Betty's and Barney's skeletal structure. And also that moved their fingers, their arms, their legs, and that sort of thing. But one of the women had a really almost horrifying experience, too, where she felt that there was a lot of pressure on her head, and that was very painful to her. All three women ended up being traumatized by the experience. It had a major impact on their lives.
Mm-hmm. Travis, I'm going to ask you a different question than that, basically. Betty reached out to you, and it was probably very helpful for you at the time for what you were going through. Have you ever had the opportunity to be able to help someone in the same type of way?
Oh, yeah, I get lots of, inquiries of that nature all the time, people that have experienced something, ask me what they should do, or they think they might have experienced something, what should they do? That happens all the time. But I do my best, but I very often turn it over to people who are better qualified than I.
So you ask them or you give them information of an organization or something like that? Yeah. Now I'm going to throw a question at you, and just Linda. In this research, thank you, this research that you have been doing, kind of focusing in New York, any abductions in that? Any abductions come to mind?
When I first started this research, I thought, honestly, I was going to talk to a lot of people who saw lights in the sky. And the first interview I conducted was with a multi-generational abduction experience family. Blew my doors off right off the bat, and I found that more often than not, people had, I will call it intense experiences because they're not quite sure what happened, at the very least missing time, many cases clear symptoms of abductions. I actually started calling the Hudson Valley Abduction Alley because it has happened so often to so many people. Going back as far as I can tell to 1929 was the first case. And they're very unnerving. The cases, people being physically tested, they may not recall the actual testing, but they have scoop marks and the bloody noses and pieces missing and sudden phobias and all, I guess, what we would call the classic symptoms of having been taken and something happened on them. One case in particular I thought was quite remarkable was a little girl playing in her sandbox, and she said suddenly everything just seemed to freeze. Time just stood still. She could see her mother in the kitchen window not moving, absolutely motionless. A moment later, she's on some sort of examining table, and she's hearing whoever these beings are saying, "We can't keep her. We have to send her back. She's damaged." She couldn't understand what that meant. Next thing she knows, she's back in her sandbox. It wasn't until years later she found out, as a baby, as a young child, she had some sort of defect that she had to have surgery and a drain put in her brain, which was still there. And so perhaps in that regard, she was damaged and not fit for whatever purpose they had for her.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. Kathy, a question. I believe it may have been actually our single-person audience out there, George. It may have been you I was speaking to today about the French. Was it you I was talking about the French? Oh, I'm sorry. We're talking about abductions in not so much heard of in places like France. Or say I spoke with Klaus Svahn of Sweden, and he's saying, you know, one or two abduction cases, that's all he has come across his desk every year or so. And a person I was speaking to today said the reason that people come forward about abductions here is because it's talked about. Jacobs has talked about it. He's been on TV, and people actually come forward. What's your opinion? Do you think that these things are happening worldwide? It's just that it's not so publicly known, so people are afraid to come forward or don't understand what's happening, or what's your opinion on that?
My opinion is that in the United States, if you have this kind of experience, there are a lot of groups that you can come forward and you can speak to, and oftentimes you'll have a non-judgmental listener who will listen to you. If you want an investigation, you can get that too. They simply don't have that kind of thing on a wide scale in Europe. I have people from Europe who contact me and tell me about their experiences. And so they're going to people in the United States. That may be changing because the Mutual UFO Network is expanding, and there are chapters in many countries around the world now. They're still very small, and you know, they've just formed, and they're in the process of growing. But in Australia, for example, MUFON now has an abduction research team, and that is connected to the one in the United States as well. As it expands, there will be more opportunity for people to report these sorts of things as well. But for the most part, they're there. They're making the reports, but they're making them to us, and not on as wide a scale as we're receiving them from people in the United States.
I see. Stan, you talk a lot about, you know, the flying saucers and UFOs and stuff like that. You don't hear you talking a whole lot about abductions. I mean, a little bit you do. And the thought just came to me in your field or whatever. Have you been ridiculed yourself from when people say, oh, you know, you're a scientist and you're talking about UFOs? So do they give you trouble about that? And what about abductions?
Okay, about abductions, as you know, I'm listed as a co-author with Kathy on the book Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. Now, she did 85% of the work, so I'm listed is the way I put it. I wrote the chapter, I was the first to publish, about the star map work, Marjorie Fish's work, which I think is very important work. And I was just reading, one of the people who's going to be presenting here said Marjorie built a model of the local neighborhood. She built more than 20 models of the local neighborhood with stars, getting rid of stars, as people were saying, that kind of star won't have planets and so forth and so on. Not based on her whimsy, but on what the scientific community was saying. And so I think she did a splendid job, and I was glad that APRO, which we've mentioned before, contacted me to see if I would help Marjorie, who wanted to talk to a scientist. And the head of APRO knew she could trust me, Cora Lorenzen, that I would. And I met with Marjorie and went with her to Chicago. I talked to Dr. J. Allen Hynek there and so forth. And she's in the movie. So I'm interested in abductions. And if I can provide something useful, I will try to do it. I don't consider myself basically an abduction researcher. I'll tell you, I took a course in hypnosis, hoping to help my son with his hemophilia control bleeding, and because it's been used for that purpose, hypnosis has. But during one of the sessions, the instructor took a woman back, regressed her. She was maybe 30 to 20, 15, 10, down to her eighth birthday, thinking that would be a safe time to talk about. And her voice was changing as she went back in these age changes, you know. And as soon as it was her eighth birthday, she burst into tears. A strong emotional reaction. Turned out her father had died on her eighth birthday. And I was so glad that that professor was there, you know, a teacher of the class, to calm her down, keep things under control, because I recognize this is something you better have somebody who's very sharp involved with. And the beauty of the Hill story is Dr. Benjamin Simon. Now, he didn't know anything about flying saucers, but he knew a great deal about post-traumatic stress disorder. And he ran a hospital for 3,000, a military hospital, after World War II. 3,000 beds for people who came back with what today, it was shell shock back then, mm-hmm. but what we today would call PTSD. And so I was very impressed with Dr. Simon saying, in writing, that the emotional intensity as they relived their experience was every bit as powerful as that of the veterans that he had worked with. You know, your buddy's head gets blown off next to you. That's a little hard to reintegrate, that kind of thing. And so it was very important in that case. That's the strongest part of the Hill case, is that the sessions were all conducted by Dr. Benjamin Simon. And, you know, some of the myths that's going around is like there was one session and he hypnotized Betty and Barney together. I've heard that. That's nonsense. They were each done separately. They were each amnesia was induced after each session. Strong, careful control by a scientist who really knew what he was doing. The Army made a movie, Let There Be Light, starring Dr. Simon, showing how he helped the war veterans get back into society, so to speak. And that's the most powerful thing about that case to me, anyway. I mean, I'd met Betty and Barney. Fortunately, I met Barney before he died. I don't know how to meet after death. Some people do. and I was very impressed by them. So I did go to that extent. And as a matter of fact, it was kind of strange. I was living in Pittsburgh. And I've been on KDKA, which is a big 50,000-watt clear channel station, television and radio and stuff. That's how I got my start going public on UFOs. I did some shows several times. They called to tell me that Betty and Barney were coming to town to do a television show. And they let me know where they were staying. Now, that's very unusual. Stations normally don't give out that kind of information. So I was fortunate. I had dinner with them, just the three of us. And so I had a chance to meet them, talk to them, listen, see what I could, how I would judge that. And I was very favorably impressed. And I was so glad for that opportunity because Barney died a few months later. Wow. So I'm not an abduction researcher. Do I get a hard time? Well, I know that there are people who say bad things behind my back. Somebody reported me today about somebody saying, oh, Friedman doesn't know what he was doing or he made that up or something like that. But let's face it, in over 700 lectures, I've only had 11 hecklers and two of them were drunk.
Maybe even more. Yeah.
When the audience took care of the rest of them. So that I don't worry about it. My basic rule is have facts in hand before putting mouth in gear. And, you know, I've done debates, formal debates.
Mm-hmm.
There's a DVD of me with James McGaha from here doing a debate at a university. And I'd have anybody can look at that and see what, make their own choice. But I've debated on Coast to Coast Radio, for example.
Yeah.
And with Seth Shostak, I got 57% of the vote. He got 33% and 10% said, I don't know.
Let's stop on that one right here at yeah, at Shostak, I just want to say something. Going back to your star map, the star map.
Yeah.
He said to me when I was talking to him one time that they actually pointed SETI toward that direction.
Well, yeah, that was one of those crazy remarks. What he said, that they had listened with the radio telescope receiver to Zeta Reticuli, and they didn't hear anything. What he didn't add was, of course, we haven't heard anything from any place that we've listened to.
That's true. Hang on just 1 second. Travis has to go, so we just want to say goodbye to Travis.
Okay, it's been nice to be with you all, and it's been an interesting conversation. Bye.
Don't forget the movie.
Yeah, the movie, yes. Hey, will that, and Linda has to go too. Don't everyone leave. I can't be here alone. Is that movie going to be available to the public?
Yes, we do have copies of that for sale here at my table, and they'll also be available through On Wings Productions.
On Wings Productions?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And Linda, thank you so much, and we're going to have you on the show pretty soon. I'll be getting in touch with you.
Yes, thank you. It's wonderful being in the rarefied air of this UFO panel.
And we're at high altitude here.
The air is very thin here, and it was a pleasure, and we'll speak again. Thank you.
Very good.
Robert, we've left you out of most of the conversation. So I know that your book is on UFOs, and have you ever looked into this topic that we're on right now?
In regards to abductions?
Yeah.
Yes, I have. In fact, it's in my book, my science fiction book, though. Yeah, not because I think it's fiction. I happen to be very lucky. I was lecturing down in Roswell in 2005, and Gloria Hawker was one of the speakers, and she was an abductee, and she needed a ride back to Albuquerque because that's where I was going back to catch my plane. So I had 2 hours with her. And I had a chance to pick her brain. At the time, I was in the middle of writing my second science fiction novel, and I wanted to find out more about these implants because my character found out that it was determined that he had an implant, and I wanted to know what they looked like and things like that. So she gave me that information. she also shared with me, it might even be in her book, which is called Morning Glory, that she had polio when she was young, and she's now, I don't know if she's old as me, but getting there. people who have had polio, my sister had it too, and she was young, but people when they reach 60 or 70 start getting reoccurrence of it, and she was starting to have that problem. And her daughter, she recalls that she had to wear a brace, and her daughter was getting married the next day, and she happened to get abducted that night.
Oh.
And the abductee questioned her, said, "Gloria, you seem very sad today. Why? What's wrong?" And she said, "Well, my daughter's getting married tomorrow, and I have to go down the aisle with this brace." Well, the next morning she gets up. Normally she keeps the brace by the bed. She gets up and she just walks out the door and forgets all about her brace, and she doesn't need the brace anymore.
Wow.
And I was talking to a lady next to me at my table today. She's also an abductee, and she said she knew of several cases where people who have been abducted have been helped by that process. And unfortunately, I don't know if you can elaborate on that. Do you know of other cases where people have been helped by abductees?
Yes, I do, in fact. Yes, by ETs.
Yeah, ETs.
Yes. Barbara Lamb has quite a list of experiencers that she has worked with who she will talk about have been healed. And I'm aware of people who have had really pernicious forms of cancer, where they have had an ET contact experience and been healed.
Wow.
Quite remarkable that this happens.
Yeah. Kathy, and I may call you Kathy?
Sure.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
I was up at the Experiencer Speak in Gorham, Maine. It was held 3 years ago or so. And I believe you talked about your own experience. Is that something you'd be willing to talk about on this show?
Yes, and actually that was last September.
Was it last September?
It was just last September that I ever.
Let me just say, did you sort of hint at it before? Because, and I'm going to tell you why. Because I was up there and they said, some people came out and they said, I think Kathy Martin has been abducted. This was in Gorm 3 years ago.
Well, it must be something that I said.
You might have hinted
at
it or
something. Believe that, but I have never spoken publicly.
Okay.
About this.
All right.
Until last September.
Okay.
And I mentioned it for the first time on a radio show a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, so I'm not breaking this for the first time.
Not for the first time.
Okay. All right.
Alejandro did.
Oh, he got me again. Okay. So can you tell us what? What your experiences
yes.
have
well,
been?
Yes, well, this has been very perplexing. And you might know this about me, but I'm a natural skeptic. Mm-hmm. And it's been very difficult for me to even convince myself that this was real, even though there were witnesses. There was another person with me at the time. I've always attempted to find some kind of rational explanation.
It wouldn't be Denise.
No, it was my mother.
Your mother, okay.
And this dates back to 1966.
Oh, wow.
And what happened is that my Aunt Betty Hill was taking part in what a scientific team called a psychophysics experiment. It was really a CE5 experiment to try to call in a craft. And they actually gave her a script. And she, at the same time, every night, would attempt to send a telepathic message to the ETs who had taken her to ask them to show themselves in a certain location or to land in a certain location. And so one of those locations was my grandparents' farm. Now, I didn't know this was going on at the time. The family hadn't told me.
You had no idea this
I had no idea this was that Betty was doing this experiment.
Mm-hmm.
But I grew up across the street from my grandparents' farm. And in 1966, April of 66, there was a landing. And one of our neighbors, who was a commercial pilot returning home from work, saw the UFO coming down onto my grandparents' land. It woke my grandmother up. And she looked out the window and saw it coming in. She was terribly frightened at that point. She woke my grandfather up, and he also saw it. And that was about it. They heard knocks on the door.
They're polite then.
Like this.
Yeah.
Well, what Betty had said was, knock on the door and you'll be invited in. And my grandmother remembered that part of it and wanted nothing to do with it at that time. Well, in the years that I would discuss that with Betty, I would say to her, why do you think they landed? And why would they just come in and land? And they left physical trace evidence on the ground. They sheared off some trees. Trees were sort of splayed out in a circle around where this came in. The bark was curled on the trees. They were sheared. Some of them were sheared up. And so I said, you don't think they were just setting down for a coffee break, do you? What was going on? And I was so curious because at some point, and I knew that my mother and I had the same memory of finding ourselves on a craft. I was on a table, on an examining table, undergoing this exam, which was horrifying to me. Something else I'd never put together, too, is that in that same time frame, we started to have paranormal experiences in my childhood home. Light orbs that appeared to be intelligently controlled, moving around. Also, poltergeist-type activity. And we had never had that in the home before that point. And so after years of research, I finally put all of this together in my 2012 questionnaire, my commonality study, which you can read on my website at kathleen-marden.com. And it's also, I talked about it in the book that Denise Stoner and I did, The Alien Abduction Files. I found out that I had all of these commonalities that Denise had.
Really?
And I had, you know, I had memories. I had missing time at one point when I was riding in a vehicle and wanted just to write it off as being something else. I never wanted, I'd have to say I was in denial. But at the same time, I was suffering trauma after some of these experiences where I wasn't able to fall asleep at night. I felt fearful. I had the classic symptoms, but I was always trying to explain it as something else.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I came to the point where I said, no, I can't deny this any longer. My mother and I had this memory. You know, these things did happen in my life. I talked to other family members who told me they also had
really
these memories.
So and it's really in every part of your family then. I mean, your aunt to begin with or earlier, would you say? Probably to begin with.
Well,
it was 1960, Betty?
It was 61. But my mother had a close encounter with a craft in 1957.
Really? Wow.
And, you know, so I don't know if she had missing time or not.
Mm-hmm.
And then I heard the story from my mother and father about how my mother went out grocery shopping on Friday nights. And one Friday night, she didn't know what happened, but when she arrived home, the ice cream had melted, all of the food was warm, and she was hours later than she should have been and didn't really know what happened. So has this been going on and we just weren't aware of it?
Wow.
Or, you know, I really don't know. But yeah. I have had some hypnosis. I had a lot of some conscious recall. But, you know, some of those memories have been rounded out more with information through hypnotic regression.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, we have, looks like about 8 minutes left, and I'm going to ask Stan a question. Stan, we're sort of closing out the show here, so what would you say that ufology needs today? What do we need to actually progress? Now, you've been at this a long time, and people have been saying, boy, I hope in my lifetime this happens, that happens. Where do you think we should go?
Well, I'm working toward a paper at this year's MUFON convention in Irvine, California in September, which is, the paper title is How to Make Ufology Respectable, because the theme of the convention is letting us get into academic and industrial settings and so forth. And in thinking about it, one of the most important things that I think needs to be done is for people in ufology to stop being apologist ufologists, for one thing, to stand up and be counted. But that means having to do your homework first. Make sure that you're not speaking off the top of your head about something you don't know enough about. I get irked as a physicist with people willing to settle for basically third-hand investigations. And we need to do better than that. But also, I think we need to recognize that it is perfectly okay for most of the world. There are nasty, noisy negativists, as I like to call them. There are some nasty guys out there who will lie, cheat, misrepresent, and so forth. But look, I've had 11 hecklers in over 700 lectures, and two of them were drunk. And the rest of the audience basically took care of. What I'm saying is, I've been in a classroom situation, for example, where the teacher had talked to the students, found out that 80% thought most people didn't believe in UFOs, but that 80% of that group did believe in UFOs. And I often get asked, you must get a hard time when they know that I come on very strong, that I don't equivocate. I say some UFOs are intelligently controlled extraterrestrial spacecraft. Some few people in government know the truth and aren't telling us. They're lying. There are no good arguments against these two conclusions, and we're dealing with the biggest story of the millennium. Now, I come on and say that, so I'm not an apologist, ufologist. And I don't get a hard time. Part of it is I'm a little sneaky. I talk about five large-scale scientific studies, for example. I show data from the study. And then I ask how many people have read it. So that will tend to keep down people jumping on me who don't know anything at all, but are sure it can't be true. And I don't think, I think one needs not to be afraid if one does one's homework. And I find that most people are reasonable. Will all people accept anything? No, of course not. I don't know anything in this world where everybody accepts anything that's somewhat controversial. So what? Who cares? It doesn't matter. And I've had the interesting experience of had a packed house out in Saskatchewan. And people sitting in the aisle. Okay. And a guy asked at the end of the lecture, how about polling this audience? I'd shown some Gallup poll results, which showed the greater the education, more likely to believe in UFOs, you know, and a high percentage of believers and so forth. And I hesitated. It's not my job to ask the people to stick their necks out, but I did ask. It turned out better than 90% of that group thought some UFOs are alien spacecraft. Some. The question isn't are all, you know. The question is are any. But so what I'm saying is one of the biggest things we need to do, do our homework and stop being apologetic about getting involved. Tell other people. Get other people involved. Talk to your local media people where people know you and know you're not a liar, a storyteller, and so forth. And I think that's one of the biggest things. And I'll be writing a paper about this. It's not in any of my books, but then go to my website, www.stantonfriedman.com.
All right. Well, thanks so much. This has been a blast. And I want to thank everyone that's been helping us out here. Robert, Kathleen, Stan, Travis was here. George in the audience. And Linda and Ryan Sprague. I'm sorry you didn't get to talk too much, Ryan. So this has been a real blast. And you'll have to come back next week and listen to us. We're going to be live again on the Dark Matter Radio Network. And this is Martin Willis saying, keep your eyes to the sky.